This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
This is from the Blue Cliff Record, Case 3. Master Ma is unwell. the pointer. One device, one object, one word, one phrase. The intent is that you'll have a place to enter. Still, this is gouging a wound in healthy flesh. It can become a nest or a den. The great function appears without abiding by fixed principles. The intent is that you'll realize there is something transcendental. It covers the sky and covers the earth, and yet you will never grasp it. This way will do, not this way will do too. This is too diffuse. This way won't do, not this way won't do either. This is too cut off. Without treading either of these two paths, what would be right? The test, I cite this old case for you to see. The great master Ma was unwell. The temple superintendent asked him, "Teacher, how has your venerable health been in recent days?" Master Ma said, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." The verse. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. What kind of people were the ancients? For 20 years I've suffered bitterly. How many times have I gone down into the Blue Dragon's cave for you? This distress is worth recounting. Clear-eyed students should not take it lightly. Well, good morning, everybody. It's nice to be here with you all. I'd like to do this talk in two parts. I woke up on some unnameable day during the week. I've been sick during the week, so things have blurred together. But it was a sign that I was getting well because I woke up in this case, and much of this talk today was present in my mind as I woke up. That doesn't happen often, but I always take it as a sign of something ripe. And so what I'd like to do is today really not deal so much with the koan, but use the pointer primarily, which has a lot. And then next Sunday, at the end of our session, to do the second part. And so Master Ma was a great teacher in the Chinese tradition of Zen, Chan, and had many disciples, was a very powerful teacher. And at this point, he's very ill. I think he might be dying. And so one of his students, the temple superintendent, asks him, "How are you?" But before we get to that, in the pointer, remember, you know, all of this body of teaching that is part of the koan tradition, koan literature, developed in stages. So usually the compiler of the collection would pull from the sort of body of stories of koans that existed and bring them into a collection. And so this means first, that those koans, these koans in the Blue Cliff Record, are the ones that Suedo felt were particularly important that he was almost certainly using for his own students that quite likely had been very important to him in his own development, and then would supply a pointer, the verse, to versify. And the verse being a way of poetically and cogently and in live words expressing the main point or the points of the koan itself as a way to further bring them out and for the koan student to further clarify. Sometimes a student will work with a koan and pass through it and feel clear, and then when they encounter the verse, or in the Gateless Gate, when they also do the commentary, they will get stopped. And that's wonderful in a way, because what that's showing is that there are things that are still not clear, sometimes about the point that they have passed through, that are still need to be made clear, and sometimes about other aspects of the koan that are being brought out that may not be the main point but are important or are made important by the verse or the commentary bringing a focus to them. And so it's interesting, sometimes they will pick up on certain aspects that the student, him or herself, may not initially see as important, and sort of just pass through or pass over, but then the verse of the commentary really turns it into something much more significant. And then the commentary, the pointers, were generally added later, usually by a disciple. And then the commentaries, which are much more, or like teishos, basically. So you really look at these commentaries and these collections as teishos that were given on these koans. And so in the pointer, it says one device, one object, one word, one phrase. The intent is that you'll have a place to enter. And this is always, and in always, and in all encounters, in all things, true. In facing an object, in facing not a single thing. In sickness and in health, in success and failure, in times of peace and times of war, in our living and dying. The intent is that you'll have a place to enter. This is how Buddhism sees life. This is how Buddhism sees what life is about, really. Is not to just have experiences, accumulate good ones, and forget about the bad ones, but to have a place to enter. And of course, the intent here, there is intent. The intention of Master Ma in facing an object or a situation or a time, it's not that that has an intent for you to enter. But even when Master Ma has an intention and provides that to us, that doesn't mean that we enter. In a sense, those intentions have to align. The intention of the student or the potential of everything in our life has to align with our intention. And that's why establishing aspiration in Buddha Dharma and in practice are so essential. And not just as something that we cultivate or bring forth, express, and then put on the shelf, but that we live and we renew and we strengthen and we live in. To enter means to pass, to shift, to awaken, to see the nature of self, the nature of other. That means all those around you. It means things, the nature of things. It means time. It means space. And so these devices, objects, words, phrases are some of the instruments in the Zen tradition and in Buddhist tradition of teaching and of providing or expressing that intention to enter. How then can they become a nest or a den? How can they become an intention? So Master Ma having an intention, a teacher having an intention, an offering, is like a gift. And like any gift, we can do what we will with it. We can receive that gift or not. We can open up that gift or not. The intention does not determine result. You know, the Buddha said intention is karma. And sometimes students misunderstand this to mean that if I have a right intention, then the result of that intention will be what I want. If the intention is good and true, then there will be good karma as a result of that. There may also be other consequences. But it doesn't determine anything. Intention, in a sense, opens a particular door. And so if our intention is clear, selfless, then that opens a particular door, we might say. If we have a very different basis for our intention, we might think of that as opening a different door. And so how each of us receives what's offered can open a door or not. It can help us to see into the bondage of the self, or it can refortify it. It can strengthen our faith in this Dharma, or it can bring forth doubts. And so a good thing to reflect on is, you know, what are we, what are you as an individual, me as a practitioner, open to? What are we seeking? Wherever we are on the path. And what is our capacity at this moment? Which is a very interesting thing. Capacity is a very interesting thing in human nature. Because of Buddha nature, because of our basic nature, our fundamental capacity is always limitless, boundless. Its very nature is to have no edges, no limits. Which means any limit we experienced is something that has been constructed. Which doesn't mean that it's a lie, but it does mean it's constructed. Being constructed, its nature is to change. And that change can be to be strengthened, either in a positive, negative way, or to be dissolved. And so what is your present capacity at this moment? Can you know that with any certainty? Can any of us know that at any certainty? When we think we do, then we have essentially put ourselves into a box. And so an aspect of practice, an aspect of what we speak of as not knowing, is knowing, is being very clear at every moment that we do not know our capacity. And not in a theoretical sense. And in the beginning, maybe it's more based on faith in the Dharma. But as we see ourselves encountering limits over and over and over again, and sometimes seeing those as being intractable, but then they shift. That door opens. Something is seen. Something is released. And we realize that that was not a limit. That in fact was a place to enter. Then it gets easier and easier to just live within that. It's not even a faith so much. It's just an understanding. that even while we may be subject to our own limitations and the ways the limitations other people may impose on us, that all of those are constructed. He says, the great function appears without abiding by fixed principles. The intent is that you'll realize there is something transcendental. The great function here is your basic nature. The great function has no fixed principles. It's not just that it appears without abiding, but that it has no fixed principles. The great way is not difficult. The great function is your Buddha mind, your original mind, your everyday mind. It's your basic space. When he goes on to say, this way will do and not this way will do, what he's doing is something that is expressed over and over and over in the teachings since the beginning, which is basically to bring out in advance the nest and the den. You know, it's interesting, in the early years, very early years, when Buddhism was, you know, still wet with our birth juices, and we were just really getting started and struggling. Well, I mean, to pay our rent, basically. And the sense of what Buddhism was, its prevalence within our culture, was in a very different place. A very different place. And so when people would come here to practice, we were sort of in this place of like, do we, you know, there's a kind of almost apologetic or shyness or fear, maybe, about saying, okay, when we sit, we're actually going to sit in stillness, and when we do liturgy, there are going to be prostrations, because there was a lot of reaction to that. And then what we found, that it was much, much better for everybody to actually put all the cards on the table and say, this is what we're going to do. And so while you're sitting, it's not unlikely that you're going to experience some discomfort. It's not unlikely that you're going to be restless within yourself and want to leap out of your skin. It's not unusual that you may resist or feel resistance towards liturgy. And so we would, in a sense, bring out those concerns or those fears or those encounters that were going to happen in advance. And so we would basically be saying, don't be startled. And don't be overly concerned. And so this, in a sense, is what's being done here. This way we'll do, not this way we'll do. This is one way we can approach or misunderstand the Buddha Dharma. Right? Just go with the wind. Go with the flow. Right? Usually that means, do whatever I want. Or let others do the heavy work. I remember talking to a young fellow many years ago who was applying for residency, I think, and he said he was living a life of voluntary poverty. And I said, how do you do that? How's that working? And he said, well, I basically just, you know, sleep at my friends' houses and eat their food. And I said, but what do you give back? There was not much of an answer. This way won't do. Not this way won't do either. This is too cut off. So to seek refuge in our zazen, that's all I need to do. Just sit and everything's going to be okay. This is my contribution to the world. This is my way of serving all sentient beings. To seek refuge in any aspect or conception of emptiness is to turn one's back on the world. This is too cut off, he says. And so basically he's presenting these two paths of accumulating desires or rejecting the world. And so when the superintendent asks Master Ma, how is your venerable health been in recent days? The footnote to that says this fellow has broken down quite a bit. He's dragging others. He's dragging in other people. And this is one of the important ways in which koans function. Because language, in a sense, defines reality for us. It tells us what things are. That we, in a certain sense, can rely on the language to do the work. And so we can express an emotion or say, I feel this way, I feel sad, or I feel angry. And sort of let that word do the work of that sort of, rather than examining what's actually happening. Anger is just a word. Sadness is just a word. What does that mean? What's really going on? And so much of the language of Zen in the koans is using language in ways that we would ordinarily understand in a very obvious and straightforward way. He's dragging in other people. And in that way, what it does, its intent is to provide a place to enter. And very often in entering, what first happens is we get stuck. You know, it's like seeing a beautiful place you want to get to. And as you're hiking to get there, you get mired in like a swamp. And you just want to get to that place. So this is just an obstruction. So we get fixated on that, and this just becomes a nuisance. And so that's often what happens, is we want to just go move on, and yet we get stuck in this very simple language. What is he saying? This fellow, too, broke down quite a bit this week and dragged in others. This is our mutuality. This is our codependence. When we deny it, we cut ourselves off from each other, which means we will inevitably hurt each other and ourselves. It's like defying the nature of things. If we don't understand it, this mutuality, then we can and will often indulge it for our selfish gain. And this breaking down and dragging in others is something that's such an important and very rich part of Sangha life. We're here to practice, to realize liberation from self-clinging. And we do so, we must do so from within our own karmic habits and forces of attachments. And some of us enter into training are very comfortable with and sort of easily care for others. And others have not had much experience at that. And we live in a culture where that's encouraged in many ways. So the effect on the Sangha when somebody breaks down and needs support, and when they're indulging selfish habits, attachments, is perceived differently. Right. But in both cases, whether that's true or not, the Sangha responds as it needs to, because we are codependent. To deny someone's needs, regardless of their intent, regardless of what's going on for them, is to deny some aspect of their actual experience, their lived experience. And sometimes, often actually in training, you know, we tend to think of upaya as being a sort of pristine, clear-edged, you know, upaya means it's all good. That what's being offered as dharma, as a place to enter, is sort of free of any self-clinging. But oftentimes what must happen is that to respond to compassion and know that we are at the same time feeding someone's self-attachment, self-concern. And trusting, because they're a practitioner, because this is just a moment in time within a whole symphony of such moments, that they will see, and eventually, because they have established a right intention, that they will essentially eventually tire of that place and not find pleasure in that anymore. Sometimes the teacher brings the student to a mirror by placing it before them, whether that's the teacher themselves or situation, or sometimes they just stand back and let the Sangha provide that, which is happening all the time anyway. We speak of mutual polishing within the Sangha, where the Sangha provides mirrors, which doesn't mean that everyone is going around trying to train and correct and, you know, improve each other. Just by living together, by being a good practitioner, in a sense, by minding your own business, taking care of your own work, and then doing that together in a close community, that's enough. Sometimes the teacher brings the mirror to the student by taking all of that away, providing nothing. Standing alone, now, what will you do? You know, it's like, what was the moment in each of our lives when we realized, you know, you grow, you know, as your child, and you think about, you know, the next sort of landmark. You know, being able to do this, being able to do that, being able to do this. Do you remember the moment in your life when you realized it's happening? Like, I'm a grown-up, you know? I'm an adult. It's like you're not. You realize you're not waiting for it to start. It started, and oftentimes by that point you're well into it. And oftentimes by that time we've already made significant decisions, and not necessarily understanding that we've been in charge all along. And so sometimes just allowing a person to be in that space and hope that they can see that clearly. And then if that doesn't help, then other upaya are brought forth, but always moving into the great function, the place of no abiding. The Dharma is your refuge. The Dharma is my refuge. For Dharma practitioners, the Dharma is our refuge. At the start, in the middle, and all the way through. When we're sick, when we're healthy, when we're alive and dying, at every point along the way. Having established a Zazen practice gives us an open door. It allows us to live within that open door. And interestingly, very importantly, when we can't sit, right? So when you can't do meditation, illness, injury, physical conditions, if we have established a practice, if we have developed a refuge for ourselves with the three treasures, that is never absent. That's why Dogen says that, or the Buddhadharma is a path, and Dogen said that Zazen is the universally recommended practice. He says, be it known that for studying the way, the established means of investigation is pursuit of the way in seated meditation. Here we will find what we need. It is the great medicine for the one great illness. Delusion is suffering not just because it breeds disappointment in samsaric desires and disappointments, but because it creates alienation. That's the heart of it. When the First Noble Truth says that life is dukkha, it's not just that that causes more pain, more suffering. It's that the suffering that it's causing is a sense of alienation. And that that is the gravest illness of all. And the alienation is within ourselves. And so what this means is that dukkha, what the Buddha was saying in that First Noble Truth, is that the whole of our lives are a fundamentally spiritual matter. Which means it's not just about, you know, taking care of the tasks of the day. But it's about what is this life? How do we realize our fundamental unity, our fundamental codependence? How do we realize that all beings have one essence? Because when that alienation is within us, and it is, this is the oldest illness of all. This is the illness we can have when everything else is going swimmingly. This is the illness that no external amount of goodness can heal. Because when that's within us, we look out on the world and we see that the world is alienated. How could it be otherwise? That's why Bodhidharma said to be free of the self is the greatest act of giving. To feel unified within oneself and to see the world as unified is the greatest act of generosity. this week, you know, it was just a flu, not a big deal. But it knocked me out, and so there are a couple of days where, and I had a very high fever, so there are a couple of days where, you know, I'd be lying in bed and the thought would arise, you need to get up and go to the bathroom. I was like, okay, that means you have to sit up first. So work myself up to that. It's like, okay, now I'd be in a sitting position. Okay, now next thing is you have to actually stand up. I was telling one of the seniors that I couldn't take in anything. I couldn't read. I just couldn't, no stimulation. And by the second day or so, I tried, reading was too strenuous, so I tried to watch some very bland movie. After 5 minutes, I'm like, oh, that's too much. The next day, I was able to get through it, which I thought, you know, that's a sign of progress. The next day, I watched Casablanca, and I thought, okay. There's hope. And that, you know, that in the same way that alienation is an illness, that closing that gap, bringing ourself, in a sense, together, or rather, to just simply dissolve that sense of alienation, is medicine. And so, to feel the support of you, the Sangha, was the best medicine. It was hard to cancel this weekend's retreat. I said to one of the seniors, it's all dressed and ready to go, but it's got nowhere to go. Somebody scheduled a doctor's appointment, which was needed. Hard to sort of get to myself. And so that was done, which was excellent. And not just the going, which, you know, was good, but it was the how I got there, which was medicine too. And so simple things that are received in love and as love, loving kindness, compassion, have great power. Because when we don't feel well, I mean, what's one of the hardest things? Of course, being in pain is very painful. And that can make things very difficult. But when we have a loss of spirit, or a sense of distance, everything becomes harder. And so really, it's just the power of how much we need each other. And it's an interesting dynamic, because there are times, you know, within a practice of selflessness and selfless service and taking care of others, putting others first, you know, all of these really important practices, which are not just practices, but they're based in our nature. So that when we practice these ways, generosity and patience and compassion and loving kindness, we're not just doing good work, but we're actually aligning within ourselves with our actual nature. And we're not just doing that within ourselves, but we're doing that in time and space. We're doing that with people. It's actualized. And so when we need to stop and turn our energies inward, and in a sense become more self-involved, so that we can get well, how do we do that without becoming self-indulgent? Because as practitioners, at every moment, there can be practice. And this, too, is not like an absolute boundary. You know, that we're either being self-indulgent or we're not. And so there are times where we are self-indulgent, in a sense, where we need to cater to ourselves, which is not indulgence. But it's like, you know, I realized laying over there second day or so, you know, Jimon was off to work day, and, you know, all I had to do was pick up the phone and call, but that's not always been so easy for me. And there were moments where I realized I could see how somebody living alone, you know, not part of a community, not with other people, could just sort of go, how it almost becomes easier to do nothing. And I realized I just had a very small sense of how precipitous that can be to indulge in that. Alienation, in a sense, will not allow us to become truly healed. That's why the Sangha is so important. Our noble friends. And that's why it's so important that we continually practice and realize selflessness to be free of the sense of this tethered, hindered, limited self. Because when we speak of the self, we're not just talking about our sense of self, but we're talking about our whole life. You can't separate them. That will always keep us bound within our desires and make the world be a place that seems small and confining, seems distant and uncaring. And so to be practicing, serving, caring for, being grateful for the Sangha and all beings, this is the most essential thing. It's what we do every day as practitioners. You know, the simplest truths are the deepest truths. But for them to be deep, we have to go deeply into them. So to just say, taking care of others is good. Almost everyone knows that. And many people live their lives this way. And that's good and true. But to go deep into the basis of that, to understand the nature of things, that this is how the world is, motivates us more than anything, more than our suffering, to go as deeply into that and realize that as deeply as we can. When the robin chicks break free of their shells, they're almost helpless. Almost helpless. They haven't yet discovered the freedom of wing. And so, both parents work ceaselessly to bring them to the edge of the nest. The parents, too, can only find fulfillment in their part of this ancient way. Robins have their path. We humans have ours. We should strive well to realize our ancient way. Thank you, everyone, and happy Father's Day.
Thanks so much for listening. The monastery's quarterly journal, Mountain Record, has a new home at mountainrecord.org. For over 30 years, Mountain Record has been offering spiritual seekers of all faiths a unique journey through words and images. Each quarterly issue delivers a thought-provoking array of classic teachings, contemporary wisdom, stunning photographs, and news from the Mountains and Rivers Order. For more information, to subscribe, or to read our open access articles, visit mountainrecord.org.